This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we explore the question, has the U.S. morphed into a society of narcs? Josh Reeves discusses his book Citizen Spies, The Long Rise of America's Surveillance Society. It's been 35 years since the Philadelphia police and fire departments dropped a bomb on the MOVE complex. Former Mayor Good now thinks the city should apologize. Mike Africa Jr. joins us for an update. Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian. The U.S. Department of Homeland Security's program, If You See Something, Say Something, launched in 2010, urges citizens to be aware of and to report potential threats. Examples of suspicious activity include unattended packages or luggage, circumstances that may appear out of the ordinary, like an open door that's usually closed, a person asking for detailed information about a building's layout, and changes in security protocol or shifts. Also of concern is any person seen loitering around a building, taking notes, sketches, photographs, or measurements. The DHS website is careful to note that, quote, factors such as race, ethnicity, and or religious affiliation are not suspicious. Yet, as most listeners know, incidents of ethnic profiling are many, including one in which a Southwest Airlines passenger was removed from a flight just for speaking Arabic. The history of citizen spying and reporting on others is not new in this country. And the See Something campaign isn't the only civilian spying program around. Many jurisdictions have neighborhood watch programs. The U.S. Department of Justice's National Neighborhood Watch initiative enlists community members to assist crime prevention and to prepare neighborhoods for disasters and emergency response. Joining us to talk about his book, Citizen Spies, The Long Rise of America's Surveillance Society, is Joshua Reeves. Joshua is Associate Professor of New Media Communications and Speech Communication at Oregon State University, where he is also a fellow in their Center for the Humanities. An associate editor of the journal Surveillance and Society, he has also written the just-released book, Killer Apps, War, Media, Machine. Josh, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Hi, Heidi. Great to be with you.
You write in your book, Citizen Spies, that vigilance toward neighbors has long been aligned with American values of patriotism and moral duty. What do you mean by that? And also, how did the Trayvon Martin case demonstrate this?
Well, Heidi, I think that this is really one of the more interesting dilemmas in the American experiment. You know, in a society like ours that tends to value limited power of the state, and you don't really have any strong police presence until the middle of the 19th century, and in some places, maybe even most places, not until much later, it's really thriving on a sense of a rugged independence where you don't have a need for the state, no need for the police. It's thriving on this individualism. And what this comes along with is a sense of self-entrepreneurism. But I think this entrepreneurism really gets played out in the community in a lot of interesting and sometimes strange ways. And that's where, for me, the really interesting tension is. If you have this classic American small government philosophy, a basically libertarian ideology, and you don't want the police, you don't want an intrusive state, then in essence, you have to become the police. And so there are obvious problems with police power. We all know what those are. But in a society like ours, you know, if you don't have the police, you have to turn yourself and your neighbors into cops. And so anyway, you know, that's where we get some of these problems, is in the attempt to try to turn everyone into auxiliary cops in different forms. And I think with Neighborhood Watch, you often see that vigilance and that prepped individualism And the question becomes, you know, how do you display that? How do you enact that prepness, that rugged individualism? And I think that a lot of times it tends to happen on the public stage in your own neighborhood, you know, by choosing a certain group of people that you're responsible for and that you can prove that you're responsible for. You know, maybe it's your family or it's your block, whatever locality in which you live. And then that vigilance, that individualism tends to get embodied in surveillance and suspicion. And that's something that we see with what happened to Trayvon, unfortunately. You know, but again, I really don't want to pick on Neighborhood Watch, and I really don't even want to pick on George Zimmerman. But, you know, this is an illustrative site where the cops, they openly recruit folks, where they train folks to act like cops. And they try to teach them nonviolence. They try to ensure that they don't carry weapons, to respect the state's monopoly on violence, all these different kinds of things. But, you know, sometimes it does backfire. It obviously, I think it's at least obvious to me that if you teach folks to act like cops, sometimes they're going to cross that line into violence. And that's the risk for with programs like that. So, again, I don't really think it's necessarily a problem with an individual like George Zimmerman. It's a larger social and political issue in the history of American politics.
Well, you know, I just think of police procedurals where you see groups of individuals who object to, say, someone on the sex offender registry moving into their neighbor, and then vigilance turns into harassment or worse. And I think that no matter how many problems the police have, they are at least accountable, or on paper at least, to the strictures of the Constitution. They can be sued, but citizens, it's kind of like the Wild Wild West and a cowboy mentality in certain cases, I would imagine.
Yeah, absolutely. I would agree with that. And, you know, again, it's easy for us to point out individuals like Zimmerman or individuals who would be frustrated with a sex offender, for example, moving into their neighborhoods. But these are really structural issues, as I think your answer gets at. And it's a problem with the way that we handle crime. It's a, you know, I mean, obviously a million different structural issues that contribute to this. But I think it's a recurrent facet of the way that Americans deal with risk and that they deal with personal individual responsibility to themselves, and then, of course, you know, to their families and to their communities. It's through this vigilance and suspicion.
Josh, you mentioned Neighborhood Watch, but your book talks about many other examples of early citizen spying. Can you cite a few of those and explain how they came to be?
Yeah, sure. One of the things that I pointed out a minute ago is that America really didn't have anything resembling an official police force until, you know, the mid, late 19th century, and some places later than that. You have some colonial town watches. But what I really think is interesting is to flip way back into history and see how this has been used as a mechanism of social control, in essence, and to see the extent to which our situation reflects or does not reflect those old traditions. And so, if you look back to the Norman conquest, one of the things that I point out in the book is that the Normans, when they invaded the Anglo-Saxons, they started to hold all Anglo-Saxons in a given village responsible for crimes that were carried out within that village. And so unless the local Anglo-Saxons would serve up one of their community members for a particular crime, they would all be held responsible for it. And so what it did is it instituted this vigilance that you constantly had to be sure that you would be able to find criminals and that you would be able to put them up for certain kinds of punishment to the Norman authorities. And so I feel like baked into this is this sense that the state is using us in different ways to help enforce its prerogatives. And again, sometimes those are noble, but you know, sometimes it does come down to a sense of what you might consider to be social control, of getting us to police one another so that, in our case, the liberal state doesn't have to over-police. And so in the book, I look at a number of instances of this. I look at the history of 911, which, when this is new on the scene, you have to in essence, teach people how to use this new technology. You have to teach them to be vigilant so that if they see something, that they actually say something. I also look at Neighborhood Watch, which we've already discussed, and I look at a number of youth programs and contemporary anti-terrorism programs, like If You See Something, Say Something. I really think it's a recurrent phenomenon, especially in American history.
Now, let's go back to what you just mentioned, the role of children in what so-called civic spying. Describe that to our listeners.
Well, I think most of your listeners are probably going to be aware of it already. I mean, you know, I think that this is one of the most interesting twists in this story. And in New York, you know, you have a number of early 20th century programs. You have something, a program developed called the Junior Copettes. And, you know, this is gendered in interesting ways because girls are looking at different things than the boy junior police are looking at. And so, you know, the copettes are making sure that grocers are selling fresh produce, for example. The boys are looking for crimes. And so it's the prerogative of a lot of, especially urban police departments, to send kids out into the community to police their neighborhoods, but also their families. In D.C., you see this with a lot of African-American kids toward the mid-century and the 20th century to work as police auxiliaries. These are programs, in many instances, to, you know, these get kids off the streets programs. And so what they do is they, in order to turn them into better citizens, they have to instill in them this police ethic, this always be vigilant, always be watching out for what's going on in your communities and even in your household. And so you see a lot of different versions of this. Some of the more contemporary ones that we're familiar with are things like DARE, which teaches kids, despite their protestations, to narc on their parents, obviously. And this is what I really think is interesting, and it shakes things up, is that especially with youth, this tends to generate resistance cultures where the kids will fight back against this. And so you know this with trends like stop snitching or snitches get stitches. So there are all these tensions where, you know, kids don't just go along with this, just as the same, you know, adults don't either. They tend to fight back in various ways against these programs that teach them to fulfill their civic responsibility through spying and snitching on their neighbors and families.
You know, Josh, I never heard of the copettes before.
Yeah.
It is interesting. One of the, I guess, pitfalls of all of this is that the definition of what is suspicious activity, so that with surveillance in general, we know that when people know they're being monitored, they tend to sort of self-censor what they do. And I think society loses as a whole because innovative ideas, things that aren't seemingly meshing with the status quo, may be discouraged because they look different. That's a frightening concept to me.
Yeah, for me as well. And I feel like before you had digital technology, before you had video camera technology, I feel like this was one of the main reasons that you have programs developed like this, so that people understand that there is constant pressure to conform their behavior to expected norms. And so you can look at this in the 19th century or in the early 20th century, where now we can rely on video cameras, or we can rely on Google or whatever, whatever kind of monitoring you have for your school or at your home for, you know, for children, whatever it happens to be, you can rely on those things to manage folks' behavior so that they act in accord with how you want them to behave, or so they're afraid to act in certain ways or to say certain things. Before that, you know, where did that pressure come from? And that's through really diffusing these policing responsibilities to members of the public before we handed over that capacity to media technologies.
You talk about an interesting phenomenon, crowdsourcing community response, and how that serves the police. Can you talk about that?
Yeah. So I think it goes back to what we were talking about earlier, especially in early village life in the United States and other places as well. But, you know, the book really focuses on the United States. And people would use whatever kind of notification technologies they had on hand in order to spread the word about crimes that were ongoing or that in order to tell people that there were criminals in their midst. You know, cops, police agencies, sheriffs, you know, depending on what era we're talking about, they've always tried to diffuse responsibility for crime control so that they can, in essence, spread their presence throughout a community. And, you know, police departments, sometimes they can use this, if you imagine America's Most Wanted as a television program. This is an attempt, a pretty visible one, I think we're all familiar with, of the state to try to spread that responsibility out for crime control, to publicize serious crimes typically. But cops, especially in the age of social media, have changed this a little bit. And so they're doing it for more petty reasons. They're doing it to enforce fines for things like DUI and failure to appear, drug offenses, all this kind of stuff. And so, you know, oftentimes they'll give out rewards. And if you're listening to this right now, you can check out your local PD, look at their Pinterest, look at their Facebook, the other social media accounts that they have, and see how they're trying to crowdsource crime control and if they're offering any kinds of rewards. And, you know, oftentimes they'll post pictures of folks that you can look out for in the community and make sure that you call 911 to report them. So, yeah, I feel like, you know, crowdsourcing has been there since the beginning, and we're starting to see some interesting iterations of that in the social media age as well.
Now, I thought it was fascinating in that same vein. You note in the book Citizen Spies that police are finding ways, and that includes using kill switches, to ensure that crowdsourcing isn't turned on them. As our society becomes, through social media, equally aware of police misconduct, how does that work?
Yeah, I think that that's actually one of the most interesting things. What I was discussing earlier with kids rebelling against this, you know, with developing anti-snitching cultures, you know, people are going to rebel against these moves by the state to try to recruit folks into becoming cops or into providing information. So, you know, cops have always found ways to manipulate technology to control how they're interacted with. So you've got kill switches now, you know, which perhaps will shut down certain smartphone activity within a given geographical area. But, you know, it's always been there. And that's one of the reasons why I talked about the development of 911 emergency, is because you can see how these media technologies that people were using in order to communicate with the police, in order to bring police attention to different matters, how the police took really special care to manage those as closely as they could and to regulate them. And so at first you had 911 call boxes where folks could, only certain trusted people could enter them because only certain people had keys to unlock them. And so the cops didn't really trust the population to call 911 at the beginning. And so now, of course, if you call 911, they know exactly where that call is coming from. They know who you are. They've been trying to carry out surveillance on people in order to, and if that privilege is misused, in order to retaliate against them or, you know, prosecute them for whatever charges might be relevant in the given instance. And so I do think that technology becomes this interesting way in which the cops not only spread responsibility, but in which they police that responsibility in various ways and make sure that it's not being turned against them. That's one of the main imperatives, of course, is ensuring that you're not wasting the police's time and that you're also not going to use it in order to bring attention to police misconduct.
When you talk about the 911 telephone number, you know, I never thought of it as a form of citizen reporting because I thought it was couched in a helpline if you need help. Which, of course, it does in so many life-saving situations. But on the other hand, when people are calling to report, you know, noise complaints, petty crimes, it does serve a very different function.
Yeah, it certainly can. And you're right. You know, I mean, it has a bunch of uses that are certainly socially valuable, and you don't want to ignore that. But, of course, you know, as with all of these things, they come with considerable promise and they come with considerable downsides. And that's one of the things that I'm looking at are, you know, what are these downsides and how have they been policed? I mean, the same thing happens with similar measures. You know, it's not 911, but, you know, the social distancing, narking hotlines that y'all have, for example, in New York right now, we have them obviously across the country. You can look at how ambivalent these things are, that perhaps they have a positive function. Even a lot of progressives and folks with interesting politics are offering that right now. But, you know, there are considerable downsides to having people report their neighbors for whatever is going on. So, again, even if these things do have some important potential politically and socially, they're also abused, and that's inevitable. And that's one of the reasons why I wanted to write the book, was to look at the downsides to this, how they come along with a lot of political baggage. What's the effect of that?
Josh, do other countries employ the same kind of citizen spying as the United States does?
Yeah, you know, obviously, the book is on the United States. It's what I immersed myself in. It's what introduced me to the problem. But, you know, I think it's a pretty deeply ingrained tendency of state power to operate in this way. You know, the classic examples that people tend to use are, you know, East Germany with the Stasi and turning everybody into citizen spies and all this. You hear it today where people are singling out China, you know, as being especially authoritarian and having this citizen spy ethic. But you know, one of the reasons why I wrote the book is that I wanted to say, look, this is also a perhaps unavoidable facet of liberal societies as well. Societies like ours, you know, I think it's a pretty well-ingrained impulse that's hard to get away from, not only in authoritarian societies, but also in liberal ones. So I trace it back, I think, probably more fundamentally than sort of putting the blame on liberalism or on authoritarianism, but it's a question of how state power tends to be distributed. And you can see that historically, as I pointed out, even with the Norman Conquest, this is sort of an age-old tactic by which representatives of the state are able to exert their influence across large sectors of the population.
Josh, talk, if you will, for a few moments about misinformation and misidentifications. And also, do you know how many citizen tips come in annually? I suppose because there's so many ways for them to come in, it's difficult to even gauge a number.
Yeah, I would really hesitate to put forward a number, because there's so many different programs nationally. They're for different purposes. You know, what would you include in a number like that? You know, would you include a high school that has set up a tip line so that kids can narc out fellow students? Are you talking about counterterrorism? You know, there were some numbers that were available in the years following 9/11 when they were keeping an eye on the fusion centers and the kinds of data that different local police departments were getting when they would get tips about a potential terrorist attack coming in. So, you know, the numbers are really difficult to get a hold of. But I do think that, you know, with this deluge, I mean, we can be sure that the tips are at least following 9/11, you had thousands a day. I was looking for numbers the other day for New York's tip line for social distancing, and I couldn't find any hard stats. I'd be interested to hear if y'all have a better idea than I do. But it sounds to me, from the response, at least publicly, they're implying that there are hundreds, if not thousands, of these a day. As far as misidentifications and misinformation generated by this, I mean, there's all kinds, and there's quite a few examples. You have the Boston Marathon bombing, which happened in 2013. And surrounding that, there was a lot of folks on social media, including Reddit, and they attempted to investigate their local communities and find out, oh, is this the bomber in the days between the bombing and when they actually found the suspects. And there was someone who was misidentified as being the bomber, and unfortunately his family found him several days later having committed suicide. Everybody's wondering, oh, he's disappeared, and he sort of looked like the person on the video camera footage, but it ended up just being some random person. There's also a story I tell in the book of a Pakistani college student in Michigan who's walking across his apartment complex in a college town with a pressure cooker, you know, to cook rice. But of course, after the Boston Marathon bombing, everybody thought for the next couple of years that anyone who's walking around, especially if they look, you know, Central Asian or Middle Eastern, that they must be terrorists if they have a pressure cooker. And so, you know, these kinds of things have a pretty big impact. But I also want to say that it's a bigger, it would still be a problem even if these misidentifications never happened, right? Even if they were 100% accurate, I think the social and political impact of having us all be vigilant toward one another would still be perhaps the greater threat than these occasional, if, you know, maybe even frequent misidentifications. I feel like it's a deeply ingrained social problem that we have. Does that make sense?
A total sense. And I just wanted to add that with the probably millions of tips that come in, we see this with federal law enforcement and terrorism intelligence. They're so overwhelmed with information that they miss important leads. And even the database programs that they've developed to sift through or use algorithms to find this are just swamped with extraneous, useless, and oversaturation of data. So I think we're suffocating it with data overload.
That's one of the most interesting facets of this, is that they have no way to synthesize these data in a meaningful way. They have no way to make sense of all of these tips. And so you have to look beyond the value of the intelligence itself to see the real political utility of this. What's the real political value of having us all snitch on our neighbors and be vigilant in our communities? And it's sort of identifying with the police. And if not identifying with the police, then identifying with a certain policing mentality and taking that on in our everyday lives. If the intelligence value that we generate itself is not in the end all that valuable to the intelligence agencies, there's some other political value to it. And I think that's what a big part of this is just instilling in American citizens a sense of vigilance and civic responsibility through spying and snitching.
Well said. We have a few minutes remaining. I want to ask you a big picture question, Josh. How do you think, if it's possible, that as a nation we can dispel the mentality of seeing enemies everywhere in our midst?
Can we? that's a different question than should we, isn't it? I think it's a really complicated question. And again, I feel like it's something that's deeply ingrained in state power, even in liberal societies, perhaps even uniquely ingrained in us as liberal citizens. And so I feel like, you know, the answer to a lot of these structural issues is to do what you can, but, you know, it's also to carry out the work of working on oneself, in essence, and trying to be a better citizen who can relate to your neighbors without being snitches. But again, look what we're seeing with what's happening with COVID. We're being told that people are our enemies, even if they don't know they're our enemies. The unknown element with terrorism or with pandemics, you know, it's so powerful, especially today, that I think we're in uncharted territory. I think this is going to change a lot with surveillance and a lot with vigilance as being directed toward folks that we see when we're out at the shopping center or if we're at the grocery store, or if we're just walking around our neighborhoods. I feel like that impulse is just so strong, and that, you know, the police and allied state agencies, they've become so good at turning us against one another that I think it's going to be really difficult to rebel against these things. But, you know, that's not to say that we need to be, you know, hopeless about it, but I think we really need to work on ourselves and try to relate to one another in ways that don't require constant policing and constant suspicion. I think that's the best way to do it. But as far as the larger public, I'm not sure I have a great answer to that. What about you? I mean, do you have any ideas for a better way we could manage this?
No, I think that the powers that be like to pit us against each other, as you've suggested throughout your answers, that we're a law enforcement society, puritanical in many ways. So I think that we become cynical, sadly, in ways that I think modern technology is also helping to reinforce. And I wanted, on that note, to ask you about your courses in new media communications at Oregon State University. How does what you teach relate to the topic of this book?
So I have a couple of classes that deal with surveillance because there's really no way to talk about, at least from my perspective, to talk about media in a theory class or in a media and society class, which are the classes that I teach most often, without discussing new media. And there's really no way to talk about the economics of new media or the politics of new media without talking about surveillance. So we talk about these issues, whether it's domestic surveillance with its police surveillance, maybe it's the NSA. We also talk about drone surveillance and military surveillance. So I think that these questions are absolutely crucial to understanding where we are from a technological standpoint and also from a social and political standpoint. And so I absolutely engage these questions from a theoretical and practical perspective in my courses and trying to get students to think about some of these things that they've been handed down, if it's these civic responsibilities where they feel the impulse to narc on one another, even on campus, or if it's a more general question about, you know, how do these devices impact us in such a way that it allows for us or even encourages us to develop these kinds of ethics toward one another? Because it, as you were hinting, Heidi, I mean, there's something about the technology itself that tends to plant these seeds in our behavior and cultivate them as we become more acquainted with them and as they become a bigger center of our lives and our social space.
Josh, you have a new book out called Killer Apps, War Media Machine. Congratulations, and can you just give us a sneak preview of what the book is about?
Absolutely. Thanks for bringing that up, Heidi. It is. It was written with my colleague at the University of Toronto, Jeremy Packer, and one of the things that pushed me to do this was that I had been looking at surveillance as being completely human-generated in citizen spies, where I was really interested in how the police and other agencies had used citizens, activated their civic responsibility, really, through surveillance, through spying on one another. And so I had enough of the human for a while, and I wanted to see, okay, how is surveillance carried out in other ways? And so I decided to apply that to the military context with Dr. Packer. And so what we're looking at that is really the automation of military surveillance and military attacks. How does that process of looking for enemies and identifying enemies and then attacking those enemies become automated? And so it's the link between surveillance and attack. And that's what we look at. We trace out the history of the development of automation in military technology, and then we try to give a glimpse of what this is going to look like in the future.
I want to share a little secret. While we were preparing to link you in for the phone interview, our producer Jeff Brady and I were talking about the cover of Citizen Spies, which is absolutely phenomenal. We'll post it on our website. And same thing for the Killer Apps cover. You have great titles, great designers, and great books. And I think that in a month or so, we'd love to invite you back on the show to talk more about your book, Killer Apps, maybe with Dr. Packer as well.
Oh, Heidi, we'd love that. Yeah.
Great.
And unfortunately, I can't take any of the credit for the covers or the titles. But no, absolutely. The folks at NYU with Citizen Spies did a terrific job, I think. As did our cover designer at Duke. They tend to do great jobs, both of those presses, and I'm really impressed and happy with what they did with those. But hats off to those folks.
Two great presses, by the way. Well, we're so happy to have spent some time with you, Josh. I want to thank you for getting up early on the other coast to join us. We really want to encourage our listeners to get a hold of Citizen Spies. I think right now, as you've said, during the pandemic, it is such a timely read. So thank you for your important contribution to the field.
Oh, Heidi, thanks so much. I mean, obviously, thank you for all the work that you've done and you continue to do. I'm thrilled to be on, and I look forward, I hope, to talking to you again soon about killer apps
yes.
and anything else we might discuss.
As do we. So be safe and have a great day.
All right. Be well, Heidi. Thank you.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org. The former Philadelphia mayor, who led the city when police dropped a bomb on the Move House in 1985, has called for a formal apology from the city. The bomb and subsequent fire killed 11 people and destroyed more than 60 homes in the neighborhood. Five children were among the 11 who died. Former Mayor W. Wilson Good Sr. said in an op-ed in The Guardian recently that, quote, after 35 years, it would be helpful for the healing of all involved, especially the victims of this terrible event. After dropping an explosive from a helicopter, the Philadelphia Fire Department let the fire burn, knowing that there were men, women, and children inside. But Good insists he knew nothing about police and fire department's plan of action, even though he was ultimately responsible. Ramona Africa, one of the survivors, has described police opening fire on Move members who were trying to flee from the burning home. Janine Africa, who was one of nine Move members sentenced to between 30 and 100 years in prison, and who served 41 years of that sentence in the 1978 shooting death of Officer James Ramp, maintains her innocence, but said she and other Move members were judged on alleged actions of one day. Move members have said they believe that Ramp was shot by friendly fire. Former Governor Ed Rendell, who succeeded Good as mayor of Philadelphia and was the district attorney who prosecuted Move members, told the Philadelphia Inquirer that he now regrets his handling of the prosecution of some members. Rendell said that if he had to do it over again, he would have offered those who weren't leaders plea deals. I followed the law, he said, but the prosecutor always has the discretion to use their judgment. For what they did compared to what some other people do in Philadelphia, they serve far too much time. Joining us today to discuss the 35th anniversary of the Move bombing is Mike Africa Jr. Mike, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you, Ralph. Appreciate you having me on the show.
Mike, this must be an emotional time for you and your family. Can you tell listeners who your parents are?
My parents are Mike and Debbie Africa, who are two members of the Move 9 who were recently released from prison after 40 years.
Now, we're going to talk about that, but I think people would be interested to know about the first 3 days of your life, because I know that your mother, Debbie, was determined that prison guards or prison staff would not be involved in your birth. Can you describe what she did when you were born?
So when my parents were arrested on August 8, 1978, following a brutal attack and assault from the Philadelphia Police Department, she was about 8 months pregnant. And since she was arrested and pregnant and put in a cell, and John Africa had given MOVE people, taught MOVE women how to, gave MOVE women the courage and confidence to have their babies naturally without doctors or midwives or whatever. So she was confident that she was going to give birth while she was in the prison cell, and she secretly gave birth to me in the prison cell without the help or notice of any officials. Yeah, she did that because she said she didn't want them to try to do something to me or her, and she wanted to make sure that it was a clean birth without the interference of doctors or, at the time, police or prison guards that were not serving in the interest of us. So, yeah, I was born in a prison cell.
She was so smart to do that for the reasons you mentioned, but also because she had 3 days alone with you to bond under the blankets, as I've read. And had she not done that, they likely would have just whisked you out of her arms as soon as you were born.
Undoubtedly.
Now, Debbie was released from prison for a crime that she and others did not commit. Our listeners may not know who the MOVE Nine are. Can you just give a little more background on that, please?
The members of the MOVE organization was founded in the early 70s by John Africa. John Africa was a black man from Philadelphia who had seen the system that was trying to and actively destroying life. Actively polluting the water, actively polluting the air, keeping animals against their will and locking them in cages. And he was also a Korean War veteran who had saw the destruction of Korea with the bomb from Americans and the destruction of the water. The rivers that you could drink from one day is now polluted because of the gunfire and the destruction of the mountains. So he really had a deep sense of love for life, and he wanted to do something about the destruction of it. So he began to teach his information to people in the community, and as more members, gathered to hear his information, they became an organization, and the organization is called the MOVE Organization. And my parents were two of the people that were original members back then. My mom, John Africa is my mother's uncle, so that's how she got involved. And then my father came around the organization to be with my mom, and he stayed, to be with her. But then, understanding the truth and the teaching of John Africa, he got committed to the teaching itself, and became a MOVE member himself. And that nonstop pressure from MOVE members and people in the community talking to officials about the injustices against black people, or the injustices against Jews, or the injustices against animals locked in cages. The pressure built to the point where police were called in to they would attack MOVE people at demonstrations and give MOVE people extreme lengths of time for crimes that were given misdemeanors to other people. And so MOVE just continued their fight, and eventually it led to many confrontations. And one particular confrontation, which was the first major MOVE confrontation, resulted in 9 MOVE members being taken to prison for the accusation of a murder of a cop that was killed during the siege where over 500 Philadelphia police officers came out to our house, attacked the house, attacked the members in the house, and you know, a police officer lay dead, and 9 more members went to prison.
And there was no evidence really linking any of the MOVE members to the officer's death.
The evidence that the police came with was very faulty and flawed. It was very unsubstantial. They were changing testimonies. They were lying about what actually happened, the trajectory of the bullet. There were so many discrepancies in their case. But because the news media and because the district attorney, you know, and the police themselves all had a vendetta against the MOVE organization, none of that mattered when it came to the trial. So MOVE served 10 years beyond their 30-year minimum. Yeah.
We should mention Debbie and others were eligible initially for release back in 2008 and came before the parole board many times. What do you attribute the final release to? Was it a change in the climate in Philadelphia? As well as, I know that you were extremely active with others in organizing to pressure for their release.
Yeah, I mean, the strategies that we used was the strategy of John Africa, really. We really didn't do a whole lot different, but what we did is we intensified our efforts. Right, so like the strategy to get a lawyer that could take the case and do it in a way where there was an intentional parole packet put together with information that speaks to the people's nature and their character and the accolades that they and all of their accomplishments in prison. We put all of that together in a way that was undeniable that they should get paroled. We also targeted some of the people that were saying that they should not be paroled and discredited them for their even having a voice on this case that they should not have anything to do with. The climate definitely helped too. Larry Krasner being the district attorney in Philadelphia and who was tough on old sentences that, you know, really should not have been the way they were anyway. All of those things really helped. The portions were just bigger. Right. So like in the past, we were doing these same activities, but this time the portions were bigger. So instead of giving a couple of letters, we gave hundreds of letters, and those hundreds of letters turned into thousands of letters. And we just kept that momentum going. And once we got the first one home, which was my mom, it was really hard for them to deny the other people.
And your father is home as well, we should add.
My father is home, too. He came home 4 months after my mom was released. He was the second one home.
How do you feel, and how do the others in your family feel about Mayor Good's recent op-ed in The Guardian seeking an apology from the city for their actions?
I think it's good. I think it's good because it keeps the issue out there. It keeps this story relevant in the minds of people. I'm not saying that I think it's good that he is, for whatever his motive is to do this, I don't know. And I'm not really concerned about him in that way. But I think that is good for the people because what happened has never really been fully dealt with. I mean, there's this sweeping under the rug kind of attitude with a whole lot of people. People don't really know why MOVE was out there protesting in the first place. I mean, you hear a lot of people talking about, yeah, well, you know, they were nuisance to their neighbors and they were bullhorns and all this kind of stuff. And yeah, we were. But why were we out there on the bullhorn? Why were we a nuisance, right? Because we had 9 people in prison that were railroaded, put in prison for a crime they didn't commit, and we couldn't get justice, so we were angry. And I would add that many other people would take the same kind of position if they couldn't get justice for their family members. So we were not unique in that way as far as protesting, but we were so non-compromising that it forced things to escalate. I think that is good that he is calling for this apology. I will also add that this is not something that is being done without the knowledge of MOVE members. This is something that we think should be done so that we can keep the message out there. This is we're living in a government, in a system where there's a government that will bomb you if you speak the truth. That is the real reason we were attacked. Speaking the truth and exposing the system for the lies and the corruption in it. That's the reason we were attacked. It's the same reason Malcolm X was attacked. It's the same reason Martin Luther King was attacked. It's the same reason Marcus Garvey and Bob Marley. It's the same. Anyone that speaks the truth and is a threat with their way of speaking, you have a target on your back. You know, when people like the mayor, Wilson Good, comes out and talks about this to make this an issue and to try to, in his way, right or wrong, for lack of a better term, I don't think it's a bad thing at all. I think more people need to understand the importance of this story and try to support it as well.
Mike, speaking of people who speak the truth, in our remaining minutes, how is our friend Mumia Abu-Jamal doing?
I will say that Mumia Abu-Jamal is a very strong brother. I will say that he has given me so much inspiration in his strength. But I will also say that he's really not doing that good. I won't say that he's doing bad because he's unhealthy, but I'll say that he's not doing that good because he needs freedom. And he's been denied freedom for 39 years. And I think that, you know, and with this whole thing, with this apology that the mayor is trying to do, that Wilson Good is trying to do in the city of Philadelphia, I think people should understand that this is a real chance for us to use this apology and understand that Mumia Abu-Jamal faced and experienced the runoff from the hatred that the police had for MOVE. And they used the anger that they had for MOVE and to spill over to Mumia because he was telling the truth about what was actually happening to MOVE. That the police were knowing. He was in the media. He was talking about the issues that MOVE actually had, and they didn't want the government didn't want that, so they wanted to silence him. And that is why he's on death was on death row for 28 years, and that is why he's in prison after 39 years, because he was supporting an organization that was speaking the truth, and he himself speaks the truth. But I will say that after 39 years in prison, Mumia is not doing well. I mean, he needs freedom, and he deserves it too.
We agree with you. Now, Mike, how can listeners learn more, or if they want to, help support the freed members of the MOVE 9?
People can get in touch with me. I'm on Instagram at Mike Africa Jr. They can find me on Facebook, Mike Africa Jr. I'm on Twitter at the same Mike Africa Jr. Just search for me, and I can help people get to where they're trying to get to in our support. Also, we started a nonprofit to, you know, the children that were in the house May 13th, 1985 were children that I was growing up with, and we were all in the house together for 3 years in Richmond, Virginia, and we were called the Seed of Wisdom. And since they've been gone, I started a musical group, a rap group called the Seeds of Wisdom. And then I've continued in the name of our family and the children that I grew up with in their absence, continuing the Seed of Wisdom. And we started a nonprofit called the Seed of Wisdom. And what we do is we help children to be healthy and to be active. And people can find out more information about the Seed of Wisdom at www.seedofwisdom.org.
And we will be sure to put a link to that on our website on Law and Disorder. Mike Africa Jr., you are an inspiration, as are all the other members of MOVE. And we want to thank you so much for making time to be with us today.
Thank you, Heidi. I appreciate you. On the MOVE.
Take care. On a MOVE.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org. One word, lawanddisorder.org. They just want to get a steady paycheck. Oh, yes. They could not care less about the country drill. Every mineral out, no less. That's why so many people are outraged. They see through the scam and scheme. And all this money, this system funneling, don't help poor people rub on the street.
bring death, just like they did the Puerto Rican, trying to turn him into a weak man, stole his land and colonized the natives, just like they did the people of this land. They so hella out of pocket, anything good you got, they stop it, any system that work, they block it, take what's good and give you the rotten, history repeating like picking cotton, take the number of all the forgotten, the revolution rolling over evil and true to yo, get yourself a good seat, and watch, it's time to rise, it's time to rise, impeach and overthrow, time to rise. Impeach and overthrow, time to rise. These lying politicians got to go. Time to rise, it's time to rise, impeach.